are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 20th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Republicans pull out of bipartisan Obamacare fixes talks, and a Graham Cassidy assault on your health care vote planned for next week. Meanwhile, the right rejoices at Trump's UN speech because Rocket Man. Also, a Republican budget shows how easy it could be to provide free college for Americans. And Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price learning from his boss big time. Meanwhile, Mueller hires congressional liaison. Is the end game near? And the boring story of the 2016 election. And it involves you, ladies. You. Oh, why we have Donald Trump.
Great job.
All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe a teaser Wednesday. I don't know. Sometimes I just get into that mood. We, folks, though, before, you know, look, we're going to talk about Graham Cassidy today. Because the Senate has left for Rosh Hashanah, as I will do. I will not be here tomorrow. Michael will be here. And then we will be on a sort of a Rosh Hashanah tech day on Friday as Matt begins to reconfigure our new board that we bought. So we're going to have to clear off the bubble gum off of the and the duct tape off of the existing board and set up that board. So Michael will be here tomorrow. The Senate has adjourned for the Jewish holiday. They will return next week. And by all accounts, they will hold a vote sometime around Wednesday or Thursday on the Graham Cassidy healthcare bill. We're going to talk later in the program. Fox has an amazing piece on what nine senators they spoke to, what their justification is behind voting for this bill. And we will talk, because it's hilarious and sad and disturbing and all of that all together. I think I mentioned yesterday that the House had to pass this as well before the September 30th deadline. And this 30th deadline is actually probably closer to sundown on I think it's the 29th, because Yom Kippur starts then. Although Lindsey Graham, not fully understanding how the Jewish calendar works, said that Harry Reid made people work up until Christmas Eve. So he thinks God might be okay with going through Yom Kippur.
Harry kept us working all day and night.
Yes, there
Harry,
you go.
So I think that maybe the Jews could just hold off on their niches or whatever y'all call it for a little while.
Your niches?
Knishes. I don't know the goddamn pronunciation.
Knishes.
Trying to do a figure speech here so we can strip away people's health care. It takes a little bit of work sometimes.
So
we're all going to die anyways. Why are you so worried about Medicaid? The Muslims are going to bomb us.
So it could very well be that they will go to the 30th. It is unclear, and we'll talk more about this because the Democrats are also talking about a Votorama, which could extend well into the night. And so it could get interesting. But last night, I think perhaps one of the most important things, and one of the things that people are concerned about, is that it has been harder to mobilize people this time around. There was a real sense, I think, by everybody that the repeal and replace initiative was dead in the water. And you saw Nancy and Chuck negotiate to clear the docket, essentially, in September, which has made this a little bit easier for the Republicans. Bernie Sanders announced his legislation, which he'd been holding off doing until the Protect the Affordable Care Act fight was over. And I think there was a lot of estimation that it was over by a lot of people. And you can see this just in terms of the demobilization by all the outside groups. And so everybody's trying to ramp it back up. It's with that backdrop. And, you know, we spoke about this the last time when Jimmy Kimmel got into it with this guy, Cassidy, who just happens to be the co-sponsor of this bill. In fact, the co-writer of this bill. He actually writes it, but... And Kimmel did a pretty good job last time dealing with this. In some respects, I felt that he hadn't gone far enough. But last night, and, you know, I usually don't stay up, but it was sort of teased and previewed. I thought what Jimmy Kimmel did in terms of this health care bill was really impressive. I mean, I think I may even understate it, you know. This was let's listen to it.
I know you guys are going to find this hard to believe, but a few months ago, after my son had open heart surgery, which was something I spoke about on the air, a politician, a senator named Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, was on my show, and he wasn't very honest. It seemed like he was being honest. He got a lot of credit and attention for coming off like a rare, reasonable voice in the Republican Party when it came to health care. For coming up with something he called.
Pause it for one thing. I just want to tell you something about the networks. For years, decades now, the networks have a bit of a personality, and it is a function of who their audience is. Now, look, all networks all try and get the 18 to 34 crowd. But the reality is certain networks also, they go for ratings and just numbers. NBC is the more urban network of the big three, which is why you had all those runs of like those Jewier programs, why you get stuff like Will and Grace. ABC, or I should say CBS, has always been sort of a slightly older demographic across the country. And ABC has always been more heartland and blue collarish. So you get things like big hits like Roseanne, and even Ellen became, you know, that's why Ellen was so controversial that it was on ABC in particular. And before she came out, her show was pretty sort of straight down the middle, sort of vanilla-y type of show. So understand still that there's a decent amount of truth to that. And so understand that when he has to say he came off sounding like a sane, reasonable Republican, he has to add on healthcare.
Right.
Because of the constraints that there's a lot of Republicans who watch ABC. Go ahead.
He called, and I didn't name it this. He named it this, the Jimmy Kimmel test, which was, in a nutshell, no family should be denied medical care, emergency or otherwise, because they can't afford it. He agreed to that. He said he would only support a health care bill that made sure a child like mine would get the health coverage he needs no matter how much money his parents make. And that did not have annual or lifetime caps. These insurance companies, they want caps to limit how much they can pay out. So, for instance, if your son has to have three open heart surgeries, it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars apiece. If he hits his lifetime cap of, let's say, $1 million, the rest of his life, he's on his own. Now, our current plan
protects
him.
Just those words right there, I would be willing to wager that that explanation of insurance caps has not been expressed on any news program, certainly not on a network news program. And I would imagine on the vast majority of cable news, you've never heard that simple explanation of caps or their existence. And dial it back a little bit because he's now, and he won't say the words Obamacare because of the context in which this is and the argument that he's making. But the fact is, until Obamacare, those caps were there and most of us didn't realize it because most of us don't hit those caps. It's only when you need it is when it's not there. Good.
Dollars a piece, if he hits his lifetime cap of, let's say, $1 million, the rest of his life, he's on his own. Now, our current plan protects Americans from these caps and prevents insurance providers from jacking up the rates for people who have pre-existing conditions of all types. And Senator Cassidy said his plan would do that, too. He said all this on television many times.
As you present that, I ask, does it pass the Jimmy Kimmel test? Would the child born with a congenital heart disease be able to get everything she or he would need in that first year of life? I wanted to pass the Jimmy Kimmel test.
Okay, so last week, Bill Cassidy and Senator Lindsey Graham proposed a new bill, the Graham-Cassidy bill. And this new bill actually does pass the Jimmy Kimmel test, but a different Jimmy Kimmel test. With this one, your child with a pre-existing condition will get the care he needs if and only if his father is Jimmy Kimmel. Otherwise, you might be screwed. Now, I don't know what happened to Bill Cassidy, but when he was on this publicity tour, he listed his demands for a health care bill very clearly. These were his words. He said he wants coverage for all, no discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, lower premiums for middle-class families, and no lifetime caps. And guess what? The new bill does none of those things. Coverage for all? No. In fact, it'll kick about 30 million Americans off insurance. Pre-existing conditions? Nope. If the bill passes, individual states can let insurance companies charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. You'll find that little loophole later in the document after it says they can. They can and they will. But will it lower premiums? Well, in fact, for lots of people, the bill will result in higher premiums. And as far as no lifetime caps go, the states can decide on that too, which means there will be lifetime caps in many states. So not only
pause it for 1 second. All right. So there he is. He's gone through this thing. He's even brought up the fact, and we've seen Cassidy on the news claiming that Jimmy Kimmel's wrong. It says right there that in the document that we will protect those who have pre-existing conditions. Well, Kimmel makes the point that if you go deeper in the document, it then says they're going to leave it up to the states. And we know that a huge portion of the states in this country have already decided not to accept Medicaid. The idea that they're not going to capitulate to insurance companies' wet dream of returning to a time where we can deny those people who we think are more likely to need health care, of course not. And so Kimmel lays it out very well here. All right, continue.
Lifetime caps go. The states can decide on that, too, which means there will be lifetime caps in many states. So not only did Bill Cassidy fail the Jimmy Kimmel test, he failed the Bill Cassidy test. He failed his own test. And you don't see that happen very much. This bill he came up with is actually worse than the one that, thank God, Republicans like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and John McCain torpedoed over the summer. And I hope they have the courage and good sense to do that again with this one, because these other guys who claim they want Americans to have better health care, even though 8 years ago they didn't want anyone to have health care at all, they're trying to sneak this scam of a bill they cooked up in without an analysis from the bipartisan Congressional Budget Office. They don't even want you to see it. They're having one hearing. The hearings, I read the hearings being held in the Homeland Security Committee, which has nothing to do with health care. And the chairman agreed to allow two witnesses, Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham, to speak. So listen, health care is complicated. It's boring. I don't want to talk about it. The details are confusing. And that's what these guys are relying on. They're counting on you to be so overwhelmed with all the information, you just trust them to take care of you. But they're not taking care of you. They're taking care of the people who give them money, like insurance companies. And we're all just looking at our Instagram accounts and liking things while they're voting on whether people can afford to keep their children alive or not. Most of the Congress people who vote on this bill probably won't even read it. And they want us to do the same thing. They want us to treat it like an iTunes service agreement. And this guy, Bill Cassidy, just lied right to my face. Do you believe that every American, regardless of income, should be able to get regular checkups, maternity care, et cetera, all of those things that people who have health care get and need?
Yep.
So yep is Washington for no, I guess.
Oh, boy. That's, and he goes on, but, you know, that's the gist of it. Well, that, you know, that's 5 minutes on national television, which, of course, is going to get, you know, it's replayed over and over again today. And he knows that. And, you know, I don't know. That may be the only political thing that Jimmy Kimmel does in his career. But if we could get every late night host to make one stand on one hugely important issue, then we'd all be in much better shape.
Or Emmy hosts.
Or Emmy hosts, for that matter. I know, I'm mad about Colbert and that Sean Spicer thing. But so good for Jimmy Kimmel. We're going to come back to some of this stuff in a bit. Before we do, let me tell you something that I have, and I almost feel bad that I have not gotten on this hobby horse in the office. But like a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, when I went in to see the dentist, I'm at that age now where it's like, oh gosh, I could be throwing out some serious cash on the dentist. I had one of those deep cleanings. Do you know what those are? When they start to realize that you get tartar underneath your gums. And so I made the commitment to start brushing my teeth with an electric toothbrush. And now, I mean, to be fair, like I contemplated years ago, now it's actually easier than it was. They used to be quite large. I will not brush it in any other way. I found an electric toothbrush that I liked. And recently Quip sent the toothbrush to me in anticipation of maybe we would do a sponsorship for them. And I was like, I don't know. I have my electric toothbrush. Broadly speaking, I'm telling you right now, if you're not using an electric toothbrush, you're making a huge mistake. And the thing about Quip is, and I haven't even read this copy yet, but the thing about Quip is, it is not enormous. Like every other electric toothbrush I've ever used is enormous. This is actually about the size of a toothbrush. So you can travel with it. You can hang it up. You can put it in. It fits. You don't have to buy special holders. And the reason why this is relevant is that, because I did a lot of research on this, not surprisingly, when I was choosing my electric toothbrush, is there's not a huge difference between the toothbrushes. The key is to use it. That's the bottom line, to use it and also to use it properly. You don't scrub your brush like this. You basically hold it in place more or less with an electric toothbrush. A little bit of movement. And you got to have a proper 45-degree angle, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that's amazing about Quip, because when I went on, you know, when I traveled for the last vacation, I got it just before then, and I used it throughout there. And I continue to use it at home now because it is so incredibly convenient and it doesn't disrupt everything on your sink. I know that sounds sort of silly, but that actually is hugely important because the key is for an electric toothbrush is to use it twice a day. Quip is a new company. It's refreshing the way people brush their teeth. Starting at just $25, Quip is an electric toothbrush that packs a premium vibration timer features into an ultra slim design. That's half the cost of bulkier brushes. It's basically like Apple designed a toothbrush without the big price tag. It's nice. It looks nice, and it's the convenience factor. You can even subscribe to receive new brush heads on a dentist recommended 3-month plan for just $5, including free shipping. In other words, this will make you brush your teeth religiously, and that's the way you need to do it. It's backed by leading dentists. It was named as one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2016. Plus, they won a 2016 GQ Grooming Award and made it onto Oprah's 2017 New Year's O List. I don't know what that is, but I mean.
Oh, don't pretend.
I know.
Sure you do.
Of course.
Stop it.
Honestly, the important thing with brushing your teeth is, A, you get a good toothbrush. And really, any electric toothbrush, I mean, there's some differences, but broadly speaking. But this one is so convenient. And it's not bulky. It's going to fit in your little toothbrush holder as you have it now. And that's super important because you want to use it. You need to use it. And it makes a big difference with your teeth. Right now, go to getquip.com/majority. That's getquip, Q-U-I-P, .com/majority to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. You get your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip, getquip.com/majority. All right, we're going to get back to the Graham Cassidy in a moment.
And there's just again on the blog phone number for the Senate switchboard to call.
Yes. And in fact, I think Kimmel had a number too that you could call that would reach any senator. But call your senators. You know, when you're talking about if you live in Ohio or Maine, I mean, I think Susan Collins is basically a lock no. Nevertheless,
thank her.
In Ohio and in West Virginia, that $46 billion that they needed to turn Portman and Capito for opioid care, opioid abuse care, gone from this bill. Call John McCain. Tell him his legacy. I mean, you just keep saying the word legacy every time you call John McCain. It doesn't matter where you're from. Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, obviously hugely important.
And I think Alaska's governor's just come out against
he
it,
did.
Which is very helpful. And I think with Collins, I think she is. But like, we played a clip of her a couple weeks ago when I was in the chair, and she was like struck. She got an applause, a spontaneous applause, I think at like the Bangor airport or something. So I think
that was Murkowski who got hugged, wasn't it?
Murkowski might have been. This was Collins for sure.
Okay.
I just think, you know, really, maybe also for Murkowski too, like, thank you for doing this before. Sure, you'll do it again. I'm sure that this is, in fact, even worse in some respects. Obviously, you're going to oppose this.
And look, there's value in you calling these places, even if you're just going to leave a message, because then you can fill up their voicemails. And that's just a way, an anecdotal way, in which there is this sense of pressure that's created. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But this, and I never talk about pieces like this. But this is too good, and it actually dovetails with another thing oddly enough, Matt Iglesias and Matt Brunig agreed on. So there was a piece by a guy named Jared Labor. Labor? Am I pronouncing his name correctly? Gerard Labor.
Sounding a little French.
And he sounds like a he's an academic talent development director. I don't know what that means. You guys are laughing. I don't even know what I'm not sure I know.
Sounds
what that
like a job title.
Oh, wait,
where provides, you get a lot of checks.
Provides career development resources to PhD students in the humanities and social sciences. Good for him. He is at, where does he go to college now? Where is this?
Is it George Mason, I think.
Yeah, it's not written here.
I gave you the bio. I think it's the Institute for Humanities at George
Mason. Oh, the Institute
for
Humanities. Okay, it doesn't say where that is.
Yeah, I think it's hosted by George Mason.
Okay, so he's sort of a libertarian type, which makes it really odd that he's written this piece, "Your refusal to date conservatives is one reason we have Donald Trump." Now, look. They've obviously titled this in a way to make it a little clickbaity. And he's writing about the popular dating website OkCupid. Now, but the thing is that there's this fundamental compulsion by libertarians. And look, this is a perfect example of how libertarians are not all white guys age 19. I think this guy is probably in his mid-20s. The popular dating website OkCupid announced Wednesday that it would make the online dating scene a little easier for progressives. And then he adds, who can't risk interacting with someone they disagree? Imagine the horror. Well, I don't think the point is that progressives don't want to interact with someone who they disagree. It sounds like, according to the partnership with the Planned Parenthood, that allows site users to use a badge on their profile signifying support for the nation's largest abortion provider. It sounds like people who don't who believe that a women have sovereignty over their own body and can make a choice about their their own bodies don't want to date people who don't respect that. Imagine a woman who doesn't want to date a guy who doesn't think that they should have control over their own bodies.
Exactly. Just can't be exposed to her opinion.
Don't knock until you try it.
I just have an opinion that you should have autonomy, but you're just like so controlling that you won't expose yourself to that opinion. It's the left totalitarianism, man.
He writes, it's hard not to see this as a reaction to the rise of President Trump. As Planned Parenthood has long been a political football tossed back and forth between left and right. I don't
that
even...
actually, but that's so offensive in and of itself. It's actually a frontline core health provider on not just abortion, but every type of necessary health services for women available, including many women that you probably know, including people that even if you're categorizing being an asshole, middle class woman, poor woman,
right? Of course. And so it's
it as a political football is offensive in and of itself.
I would add that nobody's been tossing it. The left has not been tossing it.
We've been trying to fund it so yes. people have health care.
Yes, exactly. He goes on to say the irony is that the type of assortive mating OkCupid is encouraging is one factor that allowed for the rise of a candidate like Trump. Now, assortive mating, as far as I know, is more of a physiological and biological term, but maybe there's a vernacular.
Also a term in need of editing.
Well, but no, because it appears, and I'm not sure if this is the case, but he goes on to explain, assortive mating is when someone partners and starts a family with someone of a similar background. Now, I'm not aware of the fact that that was a cultural phenomena. And he goes on to say it can be based on innate characteristics such as race and ethnicity or socioeconomic backgrounds. All right, let's just leave that aside. I'll stipulate that. Peoples have always engaged in assortive mating of some kind or another. But as social scientist Charles Murray explains in his book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, there was a shift to a particular type of mating in the 60s, which continues through the present day. Now, I will say this, that I would be willing to wager that, that prior to 1960, a sort of mating was at its peak in this country. I mean, it's conceivable that sometime in the 1860s or I don't want to say maybe after Reconstruction, it's possible it's less so. But maybe like in the early 1900s. No, because I would imagine the more... immigrant, like maybe there were some places on the Pioneer where you on the Pioneer Front, like in the early 1800s, where sometimes like you know, Dancing with Wolves or something like
Spanish
that.
Spanish fur traders,
yeah,
or something
yeah, exactly
like that.
But I would say prior to 1960, you're pretty close to the pinnacle of a sort of mating in this country. But Charles Murray found a special, unique thing that was happening. According to this guy writing about Charles Murray, as cognitive ability became most valued aspect of human capital, which presumably happened before 1960, but maybe, I guess, what the idea is like, you know, once the Industrial Revolution hit, your capacity to work in the farm, in agriculture wasn't as important, and so you could make money with your mind more.
It was industrial to informational, that classic cliche.
And the biggest predictive indicator for professional success, people began marrying others with similar intellect. Now, he writes, Ivy League graduates marry other Ivy League graduates, and their kids do the same, and so on and so forth, causing severe economic stratification between what Murray calls the new upper class and the new lower class. Now, I'm going to make a couple of stabs at this. I'm going to say that to the extent that people began marrying others with similar intellect, one of the things that happened after the 1960s was that women were no longer considered chattel of their husbands. And there was a little bit more latitude for women to make their own decisions as to marrying. I'm not saying that there were arranged marriages prior to this. It's just that, the old-timey, sir, can I ask your daughter for marriage, became a little bit less in vogue. I would also suggest that part of the reason why Ivy League graduates marry other Ivy League graduates is because they go to the same college and they meet each other. They're in close physical proximity or closer proximity to them than they would be at another college. And that Ivy League functions would have Ivy League schools would have functions with other Ivy League schools because that's what they do. And the idea that, like, you know, there was a saying back in the day from across the tracks, and that was because I think there was a little bit of stratification between certain upper class, old upper class, and up an old lower class. So then this guy goes on to say, this is all developing at a time of increasing polarization in politics. And he goes on to talk about how 43% of Republicans had a very unfavorable view of Democrats, up from 17% in 1994. And 38% of Democrats shared the same feeling. In 1994, it was 16%. Polarization is a result of the emotional reactions that politics naturally bring out. And then he goes on to say these groups vote heavily in the primaries, these polarized activists, which pushes candidates further left and right, as represented by the ascendance of the Tea Party, and then doesn't give any example on the left, but that's okay. And then he goes on to say a sort of mating services serves to intensify this polarization. What? It amplifies an already significant in-group, out-group mentality around contentious social issues. Social and cultural issues create severe disagreement because they trigger the emotional part of the brain.
Like the emotions that get triggered when I think you should have sovereignty of your own body.
Yes,
or not.
Exactly. You're getting super emotional about me telling you what to do with your uterus. Just got to say.
Noticing
just getting really hysterical, if you will.
You get really charged up when I say
the disagreement challenges a core part of group identity. It's groupthink. Don't you understand? When I tell you what you got to do, that you've got to have a pregnancy, you're just getting caught up in groupthink, thinking that you don't want it.
In a certain way, consent is groupthink.
There you go. Boom. Takes two to tango. Trump was able to convince rural and working class people that he was the answer to their collective malaise. Now, this is largely untrue, ladies and gentlemen, or at least untrue to the extent that Mitt Romney wasn't also able to convince these people and John McCain. Economic anxiety, which never Trumpers are so wont to point out as the reason for his success, is ultimately tied to cultural issues because the anxiety is seen as a product of unfair cultural decline.
Bullshit.
You didn't lose your job because your skill set didn't match a changing economic reality. Instead, it was the result of a rigged system that benefits the elite liberal urban centers on each coast and their progressively government-independent constituents at your expense. And this guy is saying that may not be true, I think. He's just sort of saying that's what their reasoning is.
Yeah.
Now, what that's called is the same racism that existed when they voted for Mitt Romney and for John McCain. In a less polarized environment, that shtick might be seen for the nonsense that it is. If a progressive doesn't want to date a conservative and vice versa, that's perfectly fine. Everyone has deal breakers. But as a political protest, this form of virtue signaling is counterproductive in the long run. Yeah, but the point is, it's not virtue signaling. It is, I think women should have a right to choose what they will do with their reproductive system. Yeah. It means I think that people who are against that shouldn't shut down access for poor women to health care. It's not virtue signaling. It is, I don't want to hang out with you because if you don't believe in my fundamental right to control my own body, it's going to be a super uncomfortable, you know, first date.
Wow.
And so, sorry,
are you putting his picture up there to sort of double the joke with it might be an uncomfortable first date regardless? Are you doing that, Matt? Next thing you're going to say that you don't support ramming a car into nonviolent anti-racism protesters. Jesus Christ, you're so satisfied with yourself.
So self-righteous. You would never use your car that way. Excuse me.
Pardon me. I'm sorry. I'm not at your moral level.
Wait, what if it was an electric car? Got you.
Anyways, want to meet up again?
All right. Please don't swipe left. So, all right. So that, I just want to talk about this one quick story, and then we'll go back to the Graham Cassidy stuff, because that is really the most urgent on the docket. But Brunig, I guess, posted this yesterday. And it's something that, to a certain extent, I think I've been arguing here for a while. And Matt Iglesias did a post that was far more, I guess, filled with charts and whatnot. But it basically is the boring story of 2016. And his first premise is that both these candidates were pretty unpopular. They were both unpopular in the sense that their unfavorability ratings were significantly higher, both of them, than candidates that had come before them. Third-party voting surged in 2016. Gary Johnson got about 2%, 2.5% more than he did in 2012. Jill Stein got 0.75% more than she did in 2012. Nationally, Trump did a bit worse than Romney. Democrats did a little bit better with white women, but worse everywhere else. So Matt Brunig boils it down. Donald Trump did not win because of a surge of white support. Indeed, he got less white support than Romney got in 2012. Nor did Trump win because he got a surge from other race and gender groups. Exit polls show him doing slightly better with black men, black women, and Latino women than Romney did, but basically he hovered around Romney's numbers, with every race and gender group doing slightly worse than Romney overall. However, support for Hillary Clinton was way below Obama's 2012 levels. Defectors turned to third parties. Clinton did worse with every single race and gender combo except for white women, where she improved Obama's outcome by a single point. Clinton did not lose all this support to Donald. She lost it to the abyss. Voters didn't like her, but they weren't wooed by Trump. And so he writes, this is a very unsatisfying story. Because it tells us that Trump won with less white support than Romney because he managed to hold strong enough with female and non-white voters, and because Clinton was so unpopular, or some people are going to take issue with that because she won an extra 3 million votes than he did, but unpopular enough, in other words, had high enough unfavorable ratings that she bled a significant enough portion of Obama's coalition into the abyss. And he says, this story is satisfying to basically nobody. Liberals don't like it because they want Trump to mean some of their identitarian arguments are true, and because it's extremely humiliating to the liberal establishment in general that Clinton was world historically weak. Conservatives do not like it because they want Trump to mean at least something about how voters are not happy with a liberal overreach, or in some cases because women on OkCupid won't date them. And leftists do not like it because they want Trump to mean at least something about how the Democratic Party's refusal to embrace transformative economic message is dooming it. And the fact is, none of those things are true. This is basically what I've been saying. Hillary Clinton lost because she was a deeply flawed candidate. And that is not a reflection on her as a person. Doesn't have to be. It could be just a function of 30 years of right-wing attacks. It could be a function of the investigation into her emails. It could include her policies or her ability to sell her policies. It could include her campaign strategy and tactics. But that's why she lost. Not because Trump did better with white people. Not because there was liberal overreach. And not because she didn't embrace a transformative economic message. He goes on to say, Clinton lost because Clinton was a bad candidate. If you had replaced her with almost anyone else, they would have beaten Donald Trump. Bernie would have won. O'Malley would have won. Barack Obama would have dominated in an absolute landslide. And so hopefully we can put the 2016 primary behind us for good, for once and for all. I mean, when Matt Brunig and Matt Iglesias sort of agree on that central premise, it seems to me that we can all just decide to date conservatives on OkCupid. All right, so let's go back for a moment. Oh, all right, let's go into the fun half. I'm going to do more stuff about Graham Cassidy. Folks, listen. Call your senators. Call your senators. Just do it. No pitch for members today. Pitch to call your senators. But go get some coffee, too, at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade. Coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. I just had to do that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Michael will be here tomorrow. I will be back on Monday. Want to wish you, if you're Jewy, a Happy New Year. Well, in fact, let me give you one of these. That was the Tekiah Gedolah, signaling that we are on the eve of Rosh Hashanah.
Baruch Eloheinu.
Jesus. So obnoxious. You remember that? That's what? Who is that terrible? Who's that? That's
what is that?
I was Gilbert Gottfried. He used to go on Howard Stern and just do Hebrew in the most horrifically obnoxious, like cracking adolescent voice. And any time there would be like, you know, like, meanwhile in Israel today, he would just start droning on like that. It was so
There's a documentary out about him now.
About who?
About Gilbert Gottfried.
He's actually a pretty funny guy.
I know nothing about old Hollywood, but there was a while where I really liked his old Hollywood podcast. As really
funny. Old Hollywood podcast?
He talks about with like really ancient actors and.
You know what that is? Huh. That's out of the what do you call it? The Friars Club.
Yes, that's
he's
right.
A Friars Club
that
guy.
Sounds very Friar Club-y. Yep. I think it looks like I'm going to talk to Jeff Stein tomorrow on healthcare stuff. So we'll keep with that theme.
Beth Ella Haina. Oh, we'll talk about this. If we have time, we're going to talk about this, Jeff Stein, because Jeff Stein is the one who went around to interview all of the senators, or nine senators. It is amazing how little they know about what they're about to vote on. And we'll talk about this in the fun half, but it really is stunning. I think there's a decent chance this is going to pass, and they're going to have no idea of what the implications are. They so badly want the win. And, you know, yesterday we were talking about why is Patty Murray on Monday agreeing to this bipartisan deal where there's like waiver opportunities and whatnot under the Affordable Care Act. And at the very least, it turns out because I think they had a sense that they were about to pull out the rug. Like this forced the Republicans' hand. And they had to short circuit that process to garner more support for what they're doing now. So this is real, folks. And everybody took a nap, and now it's time to wake back up and call your senators. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.
Oh,